It's my pleasure to introduce a man who needs no introduction, Rabbi Dr. Abraham Chwersky, who I believe I first heard speak, I believe at either an OU convention or an RCA convention many years ago. And I remember the comment he said that sticks in my mind. He started his career actually as a pulpit rabbi in the 1950s. And he said he gave up the rabbinate after a couple of years because at that time the rabbinate was weddings and funerals and speeches, and he didn't feel it was an opportunity to really directly, I know it's sort of a funny comment, but as I remember it, it's a true comment from the 50s, to really impact on the kishkas of people to help them change, not just the speeches and the times, the life cycle events. And therefore he became a medical doctor, a psychiatrist, and I think his career has been a legendary career. He, as I'm sure many of you know, has tackled many of the very important issues in our community, issues that other people don't like to tackle. I also remember him commenting once that it's his job to talk about the things that nobody wants to talk about, that wants to sweep under the carpet. And he says the carpet is full. There isn't any room to sweep anymore. So sometimes we've got to come and talk. These are wife abuse, alcoholism, many, many of the serious problems, you know, gambling that affect the Jewish community, the Orthodox community, the non-Orthodox community, and really the way he has affected many, many people. He has he founded a world-famous, you know, drug and alcohol rehab center. He's the author of many, many books on tefillah, comes from a Hasidic background. He's got very, very well-rounded, a person of many, many talents, who's written, I don't know, over 50 books, if I'm not mistaken, articles. He's a fantastic speaker. I've had the pleasure of hearing him, and it's really an honor to have him here for our Torah in Motion conference. I want to introduce him. He'll be talking now at 11:30, of course, and then at 3:30, Dr. Malamud Elliott will be doing a one-on-one interview, really beginning of our faith series that we're planning to do. We have planned. We have flyers around. To sit down with, you know, prominent people and discuss with them on a personal level issues of faith, how they became who they are, the issues they see. So that'll be at 3:30 after this is lunch. And without further ado, Rabbi Dr. Abraham Chwersky.
Thank you so much. Sound carrying everywhere? Can you hear?
Okay, all right.
If I'm not mistaken, the title that I'm supposed to talk about is
Is There Spirituality in Judaism, right?
Isn't it a strange title? I'm sorry? Many years ago, I attended a weekend retreat for Jewish recovering alcoholics and addicts in a group called JACS, Jewish Alcoholics, Chemically Dependent, Significant Others. And they had a Shabbaton that I attended. And someone came over to me and said, "Isn't there any spirituality in Judaism?" I said, "What?" They said, "Well, how come all the books on spirituality are written by priests?" It struck me then that there is this type of perception. So I wrote a book then modeled after the Alcoholics Anonymous book of One Day at a Time, taking a particular thought and developing it one day at a time. And so I wrote a book called Living Each Day, which was written for the alcoholic. Strangely enough, it's gone through many printings and has been very well received by people who have no idea about alcoholism at all. And that was my first attempt to try and talk about spirituality in Judaism. But it's very interesting that the concept of spirituality in Judaism was talked about a long, long time ago, about 900 years ago, by the great Ramban, where the Torah tells us Kadoshim to you. You are to be holy. And the Ramban says, what does it mean to be holy? It means to say, look, if you do all the mitzvahs, you keep Shabbos, keep kasher, taras ha-mishmocha, put on tefillin, tzitzah, sukkah, shofar, all the 630 mitzvahs, then one is holy. And the Ramban says, not so. The Ramban says it's possible to be technically observant of all the mitzvahs in the Torah, all 613, and be a very vulgar, non-spiritual person. He coined the phrase, Naval Birshut HaTorah, a person who is vulgar with the authentication of Torah. And he says, Kedoshim to you, to be holy means over and above the 613 mitzvahs, to be a kodesh, to be holy. Okay. Now, what does that mean? I think that we, if look at our contemporary Musa Sefulim, it's very interesting what the history of Musa in Yiddishkeit has been. Many years ago, we had the classics Sefulim, Chovet HaVadoz, Rabbeinu Yonah, etc. This was hundreds of years ago. And then just several hundred years ago, the great Sefer Mesilat Yesharim, Path of the Just. And it seems that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has provided in every generation what that generation needs. And so, more recently, there's the great work by Eliyahu Dessler, Mitam Eliyahu, and the wonderful Sefer, I don't know that it has been in any way translated in English, by the late Rav Shlomo Valbe, Alei Shur. And in Alei Shur, he deals with some very contemporary problems. It's the first Sefer that I saw that has a section on self-awareness, to be aware of oneself, an important psychological concept. And then he has another section to define what is Adam, what is meant by being a human being. Realize that in the year 2007, right, we need a definition of what it means to be a human being. Now, if we would look to the secular definition of a human being, as we learned in biology, is that a human being is Homo sapiens. Look in any biology book, and a human being is Homo sapiens. And I'm sure that if I came up to you and I said, you know, you are a Homo sapiens, you'd probably say, no, that's what I am. But that's because we don't translate it well. We hear it in Latin. But what does it really mean? Well, homo refers to a group of living things, the group of creatures, a group of animals, that are the hominoids. And that is the gorillas and the apes and the orangutans and the baboons and the chimpanzees and the monkeys. That whole group belongs to homo. And man belongs in that group. Well, what singles him out? Homo sapiens. What does sapiens mean? Intellect. Okay. Now, you wouldn't be insulted if I told you you're a Homo sapiens. But how would you feel I would told you you're a baboon with some intellect? You'd be insulted. Why are you calling me names? But that's the secular concept, that what makes a human being human is that we have more intelligence than animals. If this were true, then the finest human being would obviously be the one who is the greatest intellect. Before World War II, the most advanced intellectual country in the world was Germany. The most universities. Clearly, intelligence itself does not make a human being. Now, we don't knock intelligence. It is important. But it's not the only thing that makes a human being. So I think that inasmuch as Ravalda points out so clearly, the Torah was given to people. The Torah was given to a mensch. You can't begin to approach Torah unless you are first a mensch.
And I said, well, what do you mean? I'm not a mensch? Of course I'm a mensch. Well, let's define what a mensch is. We already negated the scientific appellation. A mensch is not a Homo sapiens. Got to be more than intelligent. So let's look at some of the things that make us unique and make us mentioned. We're not talking about Torah yet. We're talking about a mensch, an Adam. So let's look at the kind of things that separate us from animals. We have certain abilities that an animal does not have. We have the ability to think about a goal and purpose in life. No, animals do not think about it. I can't swear to it, but I don't believe that animals think about a purpose in life. Baruch Hashem, I've been on safari 4 times. Right? And I've seen all the wild animals in the jungle. I don't believe that any one of them has stopped to think, so what am I supposed to be doing in the jungle? Well, I don't believe animals have that ability. We have the ability to think about a goal and purpose in life. When you go by the countryside, and you can see some cows in the pasture, some are grazing, some are just lying in the grass. Well, if the cow is lying on the grass and doing nothing, it must be thinking. So what is the cow thinking? What is the possibility that a cow is thinking, now what must I do to become a better cow than I am? And again, you know, we laugh at that because it's ridiculous. Animals do not think how I can improve myself. No alligator thinks what I have to do to become a better alligator. Right? The ability to think and implement self-improvement is a human trait. Right? We talk about freedom, liberty. Right? And we prize liberty above everything else. Ben Chorin, to be a free person. You know, I got my real understanding of what Ben Chorin was when a gentleman who came from a very fine yeshivish family and unfortunately had fallen into serious drug addiction. And he came to Pittsburgh, and Baruch Hashem, he recovered. And then he went back home for Pesach to his father's Seder. And when his father started saying the Haggadah, Avadim hayinu l'paro b'Mitzrayim, he stopped his father and he said, Abba, can you ever say about yourself that you were an Eved? Can you say about yourself that you personally were a slave? Until about Avadim hayinu thousands of years ago. You don't know what it means to be a slave. I can tell you what it means to be a slave, he said. Because all of those many years that I was on drugs, I was not a free person. I was under the total domination, total dictatorship of the drug. I did things in my life that I never thought I was capable of doing, but I had no choice because the drug made me do it. So, drugs take away a person's humanity. They take away his ability to be free. Now, you see, an animal is not free because an animal cannot make a free choice. If an animal is hungry, it must look for food, and if it's thirsty, it must look for water. A human being can be hungry, and for whatever reason, decide, I'm not going to eat now. Okay? We may be hungry on Yom Kippur and we don't eat. Why? Because we have the ability to defy what the body wants if we think it's appropriate to do so. An animal cannot make a moral or ethical choice. So the ability to make a moral and ethical choice in defiance of a bodily drive, that is a human nature. That is a human trait. Animals don't have it. Animals do not have the ability to do an act of chesed. So that, yes, a mother bear will take care of her cubs. That's an instinctual thing. But to give of oneself for a stranger? I mean, imagine a tiger feasting on a carcass. And he sees over there a little jackal who hasn't had anything to eat for three days. And is standing there, you know, mouth watering, looking at the carcass, afraid to come over because the tiger will kill him. So the tiger says, oh, come here, jackal. You know, you can have part of this. That's not going to happen. Because an animal is incapable of sacrificing, except for pet dogs that pick up human traits. They can be very loyal and self-sacrificing. But animals in the wild have no concept. They can't do chesed. So the ability to do chesed is a uniquely human trait. The ability to search for truth. Animals don't search for truth. The ability to be humble. The ability to forgive. Animals cannot forgive. They say elephants remember forever. Not only elements remember forever. If you irritate an animal, and 10 years later you come back and he has the chance to attack you, he will. Animals do not know how to forgive. So there's another possibility. And animals do not know how to delay gratification. They want something, they must go for it. A human being says, I want this and I have the ability to do it, but not today. Put it off for 10 days, for 2 weeks, for 3 weeks, for a month. We have the ability to delay gratification. We have the ability to have perspective. What do I want to do with my future? I'm not talking about the squirrels who store away hoard nuts for the winter. But I'm talking about thinking ahead. What do I want to do with the next 10 years, 15 years, 20 years? Those are our concepts of perspective. So, animals do not have that. Now, I don't know how many traits I've listed. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. We can probably think of many traits which are unique to a human being. Now, for the sake of simplicity, I take all of those unique human traits and I say that sum total of all of the traits and the abilities that a human has that animals do not have, that is what I refer to as the spirit. The human spirit. It's not a religious concept. I'm not talking about neshama. I'm talking about all the abilities that a human being has, right, which constitute the spirit. And that exercising those abilities makes a person into a mensch. Makes him into a true human being. And if one does not exercise those abilities, then what is one? One is a human, a homo sapiens. One is essentially an intellectual animal, but not a human being. To be a human being, you have to implement all of the elements of the spirit. And then a person is spiritual. So what is the spirituality? Spirituality is simply being the finest human being that one can be. Implementing all of the unique traits that a human being has. Spirituality is not necessarily a religious concept. It's conceivable that a person can be irreligious, an atheist, and he can still be spiritual. According to this definition. Okay. Well, we'll have to talk a little bit as to where religion does come in. Now, this is an important concept. Because, you see, if we realize that we are really a composite creature, we have a physical body, but you know something? This physical body is essentially an animal body. What makes us unique is not our body. What makes us unique is our spirit, which is the intellect, plus all the other traits that we have said. So we have a body and a spirit. Now, the importance of this is that if the body is deficient in any one essential nutrient, then the body shows symptoms of dysfunction. So the body needs iron. And what happens if you're deficient in iron? You develop an iron deficiency syndrome, an iron deficiency condition. And there's symptoms of this, medical symptoms of it. And so a person goes to the doctor does the blood test, and comes up with a diagnosis, iron deficiency. Okay. So what do you do about it? Now what would you do if you were a doctor, and somebody comes with an iron deficiency, what would you give them? Iron, of course. And if you don't give the person iron, he's not going to feel better. Now, you can give him zinc and copper and selenium and vitamin A and vitamin B and vitamin C, vitamin D. Nothing is going to change unless you supply the missing substance. And this is true because vitamin C deficiency is only get better if you give him vitamin C. That's true physically. But we're more than physical. We said that we have a spirit. And the spirit, too, has its nutrients. And if you don't give the spirit the nutrients that it needs, you're going to develop a spirituality deficiency condition, which is as real as iron deficiency and vitamin C deficiency. There's no blood test for that. But what is the symptom? Very interesting. The symptom of lack of spirituality that I refer to as SDS, okay? Spirituality Deficiency Syndrome. The symptom of that is chronic dissatisfaction, chronic discontent, chronic unhappiness in life. Now, if the unhappiness in life is due to that, to spirituality deficiency, it's not going to get better if you give an antidepressant. Right? Just like a vitamin C deficiency is not going to be healed if you give vitamin D. And the problem is, it's a problem with the layperson, it's a problem with the therapeutic community. That when a person comes in who complains of being unhappy, chronically unhappy, they begin to search. Does he need an antidepressant? And if it's not an antidepressant kind of thing, what happened to him in his early life, an early life trauma he didn't have? None of that may help if the problem is a spirituality deficiency. And I challenge psychologists and psychiatrists to say, have you last asked your patient, has he or she been exercising their spirituality? Now, I know that we are taught, don't get involved in the patient's religion. That's not the job of a therapist. I say, you're right. I don't get involved in the patient's religion. Right. But I have to get involved in the patient's humanity. And if there's a possibility that the patient is suffering, is discontent, because she or he are not being self-fulfilled because they're not exercising their spirituality, then it's my business as a therapist to point this out to them. Serious deficiency among psychotherapists. It's a kind of revolutionary thing to say, but I believe it's absolutely true. If we recognize SDS, then we realize that there cannot be any happiness unless the person fulfills oneself spiritually. All right, so we understand now what it means to be a mensch. And that the Torah is given to a person who's a mensch. And what the Ramban is saying is that if a person acts like an animal, in that all of his life is dedicated to self-gratification. Because incidentally, the classic example of an animal is that an animal will not do anything that's not self-gratifying. Right? Except as that pet dogs who pick up a human trait. But otherwise, an animal is driven by self-gratification. And if the only thing that motivates a person is self-gratification, whichever way it is, that person is not yet a mensch. And if the person is not yet a mensch, then there's no sense in talking Torah to him. First be a mensch. It's not for naught that our Chazal, who were so unbelievably bright, say that by the Sheva Brochas, young couple gets married. Say, I've had Mekudeshah, so now they're husband and wife. So what kind of brocha do they make? Baruch ato Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam, Yotzer HaOdom, created a mensch. What's that got to do with the chuppah? But this is a message to a young couple. You want a happy marriage, be menschen. If all you're going to look out for is your own pleasure and your own gratification, you're not a mensch. Okay. And I can tell you that a majority of failed marriages is because people were looking out for their own gratification, right? What they can get out of the relationship instead of what they can give to it. Happy marriages are between menschen. There are such marriages. I would just wish there were more of them. So, is there spirituality in Judaism? Of course, it's basic. You can't begin, you cannot begin to be an observant Jew simply by doing all the rituals, because the Ramban says if you do it, you haven't accomplished anything. If you've remained in novel vishu satira, if you remain self-gratification. It's harder to do that today than it was when I was a child.
Why? Because when I was a child, and this is not ancient history. Maybe it is ancient history. When I was a child, I don't think anybody could have thought that the purpose of life is to get gratification. There was just too much misery going on in order to think that there could be self-gratification. What do I mean by that? I mean, I knew of cases where a woman might have had 11 pregnancies and have 3 surviving children. Because neonatal deaths, infantile deaths were very common. And childhood diseases were rampant. My home was quarantined so many times by a sign outside. Because I had measles, chickenpox, mumps, whooping cough, scarlet fever. I had them all. And there were children who didn't survive those. Baruch Hashem, we have immunization. That's taken away. I remember every summer if I got a backache, somebody got a muscle, like, oh, it may be polio. We no longer have that fear. And you know, people worked hard to make a living. And there was a lot of physical labor. And the work week was a long week. You know, back in the 1930s, you would have shown what an average work week is today. And what a workplace is like, they would say, this is a workplace, this is a spa. Look at the carpeting. Yeah. And then the coffee breaks. That wasn't like that in the 1930s. I remember a family that was destitute, that was crushed. A 17-year-old daughter died of pneumonia. That doesn't happen anymore. In every major city, there was a tuberculosis sanitarium. Young people died at 20s and 30s. There isn't one tuberculosis sanitarium in the United States. The advance of medicine has taken away so many of the miseries of life. And I remember in the days, in the 1930s and early 1940s, if it was terribly hot outside, you know what you did? You sweat bullets. I mean, how much can a fan do? Air conditioning? That wasn't around then. So, when air conditioning finally came around, it was only in the theaters. And if it was a terribly hot day, you went to a theater and you sat through 2 movies. Then you cooled off a little bit. But now, which home is without air conditioning? And the kinds of things that we've been given to make life simpler, microwave ovens, instant foods, right? Fax machines, jet planes, and then this instrument, which I'm not sure if it's an instrument of the angel or the instrument of the devil. Right? But a person can sit in an air-conditioned room and look at an event happening 3,000 miles away on his BlackBerry. So look what science has done for us. It's made us think that life can be comfortable, and we may think that life can be pleasurable. But let's go one step further. What was Pesach like? You know what we ate on Pesach? Chicken, meat, borscht, and potatoes, and potatoes, and potatoes, and potatoes. That's all there was. Candy? There was marmalade, but it wasn't too good anyway. You walk into a store now before Pesach, you don't know where to look first. Everything except bread. And we're getting pretty close to that. Yeah. There's kosher Pesach like a pizza. Right. And when I came into before Pesach, I came and I looked at non-gebrocht ice cream cones. I said, what are they, Meshuggah? But everything has been made available. You know, if you ask the average young woman from a very fine Tzedek home, what do you do to make a chicken kosher? She'll look at you if you're from Mars. What do you mean you make a chicken kosher? You don't make a chicken kosher. You buy a kosher chicken, yeah. Yeah, I remember making a chicken kosher, you know. Yeah. Took it to the shaykhut, right? And then you opened it up and took out the insides and then soaked it and salted it. It was a whole big deal. All that's been taken away from us. And life has been made so comfortable in some ways, in many ways, that I think we've lost the tolerance We've lost the tolerance for any kind of discomfort. Life must be pleasurable. And I'm afraid that we've got pulled into the secular idea that life is pleasurable. And what happens is we may become novel b'shus ha-Torah. We may do everything glat kosher, and still be failures in Yiddishkeit. Yes, we have to keep the Tayag mitzvahs. That's a basic. But we have to go beyond that. We cannot be what the Ramban tells us not to be. So, first of all, we have to be spiritual. And as spiritual people, we have to use all of the abilities that we have. We have to think about, actively think about, what we want to do with our life. What is our goal in life? We have to, of course, do acts of chesed, and this is something, of course, in which we excel. We have to think of being able to defy bodily drives if they're not proper. We have to have a sense of propriety. We have to think about being humble and being able to forgive. We have to think about overcoming our anger and developing midos. And the sacred svorim that we have on midos must become a part of everyday life. And I've told people it's not enough to keep the Shulchan Aruch today. Today every home should have a Mesilat Yesharim, the path of the just. And every family should learn Mesilat Yesharim together. And at the Shabbos table talk about midos. And exercise what the Chofetz Chaim stressed. Watching our tongues. Not to chas v'sholem say something which is untrue. And not chas v'sholem say loshon hara. And not chas v'sholem speak loshon hara. I know we joke that we take ourselves that joke, say loshon hara. I mean, loshon hara is worse than eating treif. And yet, loshon hara is unfortunately so common. You know that in 1648, when the pogroms happened, that were the worst things that ever happened to Jews before the Holocaust, the Tosfos Yontif said that the reason this happened was that Kol Yisrael is being punished for what? For talking during davening. Not for being Mechalel Shabbos. Not for Taufis, but for talking during davening. You know, we make light of it. Right? Talk during davening. Who doesn't talk during davening? I mean, Baruch Hashem that there's many shuls that are extremely strict on that. But we have to realize that talking during davening is a grievous sin. Isn't it a machaya to talk during davening? It's such a taiva. Yeah, we like to do it. But that's where we have to come in and say we may like to do it, but we shouldn't. So you see, there is such a thing as spirituality in Judaism. Right? But we've got to realize that it is beyond simply doing, keeping the mitzvahs. We have to go beyond that. We have to be mentioned. Now, one of the principles of, one of the traits that we talked about of spirituality is that a human being should live a purposeful life. Animals do not live a purposeful life. They live whatever they are instinctually created to do. And as I said, no animal thinks about what is my goal and purpose in life. What am I supposed to achieve here? But we have to do that. We have to think about a purpose in life. And you see, as I said, a person can be spiritual without being religious, but when he comes to that purpose in life, if one does not have a munah, one does not have a religious belief, then one fails in that spiritual aspect. Why? Because how can you have a purpose in life, a personal purpose in life, if the whole world is purposeless? And those people who believe that the world was not created, because they don't believe in God, but that somehow or other there was this great big bang, right? And somehow energy, I don't know where energy came from, but the energy became matter, and the matter over billions and billions of years developed.
I mean, if you really understand science and technology and physiology of human being, it's ridiculous to assume that this happened through evolution. But I won't go into that right now. But if it only happened because of an accidental freak accident and was not created, then what's the purpose of the world? Purpose? No purpose. It happened. So the world is purposeless?
Yeah.
Well, if the world is purposeless, what kind of sense does it make to think of what's my purpose in a purposeless world? It really comes down to the story of the two vagrants who were arrested. They're brought before the judge. The judge says to one of them, "What were you doing when the officer arrested you?"
He said, "I wasn't doing anything. Nothing." And the second one, "And what were you doing when you were arrested?" He says, "I was helping him." You know?
Do you realize that no matter how much you help a person who's doing nothing, you're really doing nothing yourself? So as wonderful as it is for me to help you or for you to help her and her to help him and each to help each other, then that's wonderful. I wish there was more of it. But unless there's an ultimate thing, something at the end of it, right, then if the world is purposeless, it's meaningless for me to talk about a personal purpose. So for me to talk about a personal purpose, I have to think that the world is purposeful. And if it was purposeful, why was it purposeful? Because it was created. And once we come to that, Tzadik Memunosa Yechia, once we come to the Emunah that the world was created, logically we go from there on that the power that created the world had a purpose in creating it. Is it possible for me to understand that purpose? Of course not. Because you see, we can only understand things that our mind can grasp because we have had some sort of sense experience with it. But when you begin to talk about a creator, which by definition the creator is infinite, omnipotent, endless, and we use a word for that, infinite and eternal, those are words that have no meaning to us. Because never in our experience have we ever had something that never had a beginning. Everything we come in contact with has had a beginning. And many things have had an end. And so the idea of understanding God, it's beyond our understanding. We don't have the ability to understand that. Just like a person who does not have sight, a blind person, cannot appreciate a rainbow. A person who never had any sight does not know what color means. Similarly, we cannot begin to understand anything about God. And so it comes down to a matter of faith that we believe because our ancestors told us, and we go back to several thousand years ago when there were 3 million people who stood at the mouth at Mount Sinai, and they heard Hashem say the Ten Commandments, and that's where we have our emunah from. Incidentally, someone once said, what other nation has that kind of a tradition? That several million people witnessed an event. No other nation even has a tradition like that. Very interesting. We're the only nation that has a tradition that several million people witnessed a single event. So we have our emunah. And with our emunah, we believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu revealed himself and says, I created the world and this is what I want you to do. You say, why? It's not your business. You do it because I told you so. And by the way, this is so important. This is so important. Because sometimes parents complain of the fact that their children do not listen to them. Unfortunately, too common, especially nowadays with the way children relate, with anybody relates to authority and children relate to parents. But I wonder, what can we do to help our children listen to us? Well, first of all, we know that there are ways to talk to children. Because giving them orders doesn't work usually. And we have to understand that even if it does work, the Talmud says something very interesting. If a person is not obligated to do a mitzvah, and yet he voluntarily does it, is he greater or less than a person who does it because he's commanded to?
And the Talmud says that a person who does it voluntarily is very nice, very worthy. But the person who is commanded to do it has a greater reward. Why? Because when you're commanded to do it, you immediately develop a resistance. If I do it because I want to do it, nothing is pushing me. I don't resist it. But if you tell me you've got to do it, oh, I don't want to do it. That's natural to have a resistance. So a person who is commanded to do it has a greater reward. So we have to understand that when we tell our children, you've got to do it, you must do this, they're going to feel a resistance to it. And if we want to avoid that resistance, we have to learn how to talk to children in a way that they won't perceive this as an authority, as an order. But you say, well, wait a minute. Aren't children supposed to listen to their parents and accept the parental authority? I said, yes. Well, why? What's the problem then? I said, because I want to know when the parents modeled it for them. You know, you can't teach your children anything by lectures. If you want to teach your children something, you have to show them how it's done. So, when do we show our children that we obey authority? It's very interesting, Rashi. Rashi quotes the Talmud that says, a person should not say, I detest pork. That's wrong. A person should say, I really would enjoy eating pork. But I'm not allowed to because Hashem said you're not allowed to. So I accept his authority even though I don't want to do it. I'd like very much like to eat pork, but I can't. Now, can you say that? No, when you hear about eating pork, you get nauseated. So I can't say that. I'm not eating pork because Hashem said so. I can't eat pork because it's disgusting. But what Rashi is saying is that the things that we are prohibited from doing, right, should not be because we don't want to do them. I mean, many people would not even think of putting on the light on Shabbos. Just not done. If we want to show our children that we accept authority, we've got to look for ways in which we can show them this is something that I really would like to do. But I can't because it's not permitted. Look very carefully as to how many times a day we do that. Not too often. Because we've come in the habit that we avoid doing things that are not permissible. We don't even want to do them. And I think we have to search for ways in which to show our children how we accept authority. I think the Chofetz Chaim was 1,000% right when he focused on Lashon Hara. Because this is something, come on, when there's a juicy piece of gossip, I want to hear it. Right? Can you imagine sitting around and people talking, and somebody's going to start talking about Yankel or Reuven or Shmuel or whatever, and you say, hold on a minute. Right? I really want to hear what you say. Right? I'm curious. I'm not allowed to. That may be Lashon Hara. Right? And I want your children to hear that. I want your children to see how you avoid speaking Lashon Hara. And how if somebody is going to say something that may be Lashon Hara, that you stop them and say, I'm sorry, I'm interested in hearing that. I'm curious, but I can't listen to that. I want our children to see how we avoid anything that is not true. How we avoid sheker with a poison, like a poison. Remember that of all of the things that the Torah forbids, the Chachomim came along and they made certain protective measures to prevent us from transgressing the Torah. So the Torah says, no, you're not allowed to cook meat with milk. But that goes to meat of an animal, beef or lamb or veal. It doesn't say anything about chicken milk. The Talmud says, no, the Chachomim said, chicken and milk is also treif. And then they said, you know what? We want you to separate the eating meat from eating milk. Okay. So after you've eaten meat, there should be a period of time before you can eat it. Torah doesn't say that. The Chachamim say that. But they made precautionary measures to prevent us from doing it. All the precautionary measures we have are all because the Chachamim said so. The Torah doesn't give precautionary measures. Except in one item where the Torah says, Midvar sheker tirchak. Keep a distance from saying a lie. Not only you shall not lie, right? But that here is the one exception where the title says, keep your distance from sinful lies. Set up precautionary measures. And what does that mean? I think what that means is use this as a guideline. Whatever it is that you're going to do, that you want to do, you must think, will I ever have to deny having done this? If it's something that you might sometimes have to deny, don't do it. Because that's the precaution that the Torah is saying. Make sure that you never put yourself in a position where you're going to have to lie. That's what it means to the spirituality of Yiddishkeit. There's the spirituality of compassion. And compassion is more than tzedakah. Compassion is even more than gemilas chasadim. Compassion is truly feeling the pain of another person. Compassion is truly rejoicing in the simcha of another person. That's the compassion of spirituality. And that's something which, according to our Musas Forum, right, we should excel in. Because that's the Yiddishkeit spirituality. And then, one of the most common things that are non-spiritual is exploding in anger. That's an animal trait. You provoke an animal, and an animal will become angry and attack. Now, if a human being is provoked, sure, you feel angry. You can't help that. In fact, feeling angry is not a sin. Do you know that the Chofetz Chaim used to every night go into the Beis Medrash at midnight and open up the Ogen Kodesh, and he used to cry bitterly to Hashem and pray, take the feeling of anger away from me. Chofetz Chaim never got angry at anyone. Meaning, he never reacted in anger. He never behaved in anger. But he couldn't help feeling angry, and he didn't want that feeling. And he knew it was not within his ability to extirpate it. So he prayed to Hashem, take this feeling away from me. Well, we are not the Chofetz Chaim, so somebody provokes us and we feel angry. But do we react? Do we shout? Do we scream? Do you know that if we scream and our children see a scream, right, we've taken away the spirituality of Yiddishkeit? I think that the concept of anger is extremely important. Right now I'm writing about it in my weekly column in Hamadiyah, about anger management, about how to avoid not feeling anger, I can't help it, but how to avoid reacting anger. And you know what the Talmud says about reacting anger? The Talmud says that a person who is enraged is equivalent to avodah zarah. It's equivalent to idolatry. And the Talmud doesn't hide and say, great Moshe Rabbeinu, the greatest of all human beings. Three times he got angry. No, three times he was enraged. And each time he made a mistake. The Talmud doesn't hide it. So, if parents would be careful not to demonstrate rage so that a husband speaks decently and pleasantly toward the wife as the halacha requires, and the wife speaks decently toward the husband, and even though one may have done a mistake or whatever, and somehow or other provoked the other, right, not to react with rage. And not to react with rage even against the children, toward the children. Yes, it's important that we discipline them. Right? But not to discipline them with rage. And if sometimes we have to do anger, what the Sfarim say is, you may have to show some anger sometime superficially to discipline a child, but not because you feel angry. Our wonderful Musas Forum, they are so full of telling us how to be spiritual. And unfortunately, we don't give them their fair due. We don't fully live fully spiritual lives. And if we only realized that our children, if only they saw us leading true spiritual lives, how that would protect them from the dangers of what kids are getting into. I've talked with kids who've come in for treatment of drug addiction. Invariably, their feelings of Yiddishkeit are very negative. Because what they saw is, they saw all the restrictions. They saw the parents keep the mitzvahs. But they didn't see spiritual. And I've said to parents, I said, you want to protect your children from drugs? There is no foolproof method. But show them what it means to be spiritual. Show them what it means to control your anger. And I sometimes made a very provocative statement that I said, if you lose your temper at home, you've just put your children at risk of going into drug addiction. I think that children have to feel the spirituality. And there are families that do that. But because of the enormous, enormous pressure that we now have from the outside world, which is the most corrupt civilization that has ever existed. When you read the stories of Sodom and Gomorrah, you've got today's society where everything is towards self-gratification. And the most corrupt practices have become accepted. And even the value of life has decreased. So what are you talking about? But you know that in the state of Oregon, there are some medical procedures for which the state will not pay if you're over 80. What does that say? You know that for many years, the idea of euthanasia, mercy, quote, mercy killing, right, was an abominable thing. It was illegal. It was murder. Two states have already legalized euthanasia, and more are coming on board. We've lost the respect for life. And Yiddishkeit maintains the respect for life. The holiest thing in our Torah, Shabbos, Yom Kippur, when it comes to a question of preserving life, everything goes. And if the person is 99 years old and feeble and Alzheimer's, and goes into a situation on Shabbos where you have to treat him, maybe Mechal Shabbos, you Mechal Shabbos for him. For what? The person is 99 years old, he hasn't talked a word for 6 years. He doesn't recognize his own wife and children. Right? What kind of a human being is he? He's a human being. We have a respect for human life. Right? This is the spirituality of Yiddishkeit. But it's something that has been lost. No. We now suffer from an epidemic that tends to break down more and more families because from a loss of spirituality. And that is the horrible epidemic of internet addiction. There isn't a week that goes by that I don't get several calls from young men and young women who have been addicted to internet pornography. And they say, look, we're trying to stop, but we can't. We're addicted. And they're looking for help. And so, what people have said is, for heaven's sake, don't use a computer. Don't keep a computer in your house. It's easy to say. But now when our lives are completely more and more dependent on a computer, do you realize that in 4 years from now, it'll cost you $25 to write a check? Because all bills will be paid online. There's no way to escape it. Well, you can use a filter. You can use a filter. If you're seriously intending to avoid the pornography, you use a filter. But if you've got a yetzer hara, right, a desire, right, then you know how to get around the filter. It's the easiest thing to do. How are we going to stop that? How are we going to protect our children? There's only one way, right? I remember when I was a child and I did something my father didn't like, he would say, oi, spastnish hadir. Spastnish hadir, it doesn't suit you. What are you doing? It's beneath your dignity. He never told me that I was bad. Told me that I was too good for something. Incidentally, I must tell you one thing, even though it's not real, because my free association, I have to tell you the story, because it's one of my best memories. When I was a child, I became a very good chess player. almost a chess champion. And I used to play chess with the people in shul before mincha. And they were good chess players, and I beat them all. Well, we had one Rosh Hashanah. There was a very fine rov from Chicago who came to be with us Rosh Hashanah. And the first day Rosh Hashanah in the afternoon, he comes up to me and he says, "So spielen Schach? Want to play chess?" I said, "Yontif." He says, "No." "So what? Who says you can't play chess on Yontif? What's your problem?" "Well, okay, if you're allowed to, okay." So I played him two games, and I beat him both times. Second night, Rosh Hashanah, Shamus comes over to me, and he says, "The Rebbe wants to see you in the study." So I came in, and my father was sitting looking in the sefer. And I didn't come and say, "Hey, Dad, what do you want?" It's not the way it went. I came in. I stood quietly, waiting for him to recognize me. And he let me stand there for a few minutes. He was instinctively a good disciplinarian. He let me stand there for a few minutes, looking into a sefer. And then after a few minutes, he looks up. "You play chess on Rosh Hashanah?" I said, "Yeah, Abrahamovich said you're allowed to." He didn't say a word. He looked back down into his sefer. That's all. He didn't say a word. He just shook his head. I got the message. The message is very clear. The rov was right. Technically, you're allowed to. But even though you're allowed to, it's not a Rosh Hashanah to take up behavior. So I understood. Okay. But I got my message. But I wasn't free to leave because he had to tell me, "Geh gesund to heit." So I stood there, He's looking at the sefer. Let me stand there a few minutes. After a few minutes, he looks up and he says, "You beat him?" I said, "Yeah, twice." Geh gesund to heit. You know, the trick of disciplining a child and not letting the child feel bad with the discipline. That's an art. And we got to realize we were not all born instinctive parents. Right? We were not born surgeons. We were not born accountants. Right? We have to learn how to be parents. And to be a parent means, to be a Jewish parent means to be a spiritual parent. So spirituality comes in there also. So, my friend, I do want to leave about 10 minutes for questions. So I'd like to sum up by saying, is there spirituality in Judaism? Of course, of course, of course. There's more spirituality in Judaism than anything else in the world. But we have to look for it. We have to look for the sources. I will strongly suggest that if we don't have in our library the wonderful Shulam, especially the contemporary Shulam, of the Path of the Just, the Mesilas Yesharim, the Milas Hamidas, all the Yochel Sadikim, all the kinds of books that talk about the Midas that we're supposed to have, the Mishnah Me'eliyahu, many of which have been translated into English for the English reading population, and especially the biographies that we have of our Tzaddikim, the biographies that we have of people in our own generation that were great people and who were truly spiritual people. Right? Here in Toronto, you had Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, right? Not only a great Goan and Tzaddik, but a tremendously spiritual person. We saw with our own eyes Reb Moshe Feinstein. I was privileged to see, I didn't get to see the Chazon Ish, but I had a very close relationship with the Stipula. And we have people in our own generation, men, women, who lived spiritual lives. And if we model ourselves after them, yes, there is spirituality in Judaism. But we can't take it for granted. We have to look for it. And I'm sure that if we look for it, we'll find it. And we will live spiritual lives. We will not have the spirituality deficiencies in them. We will not have chronic unhappiness. Right? And we'll be able to be model for our children. So let HaKadosh Baruch Hu help us that we achieve the spirituality, that we achieve happiness in life, and that we have nachas from all our children and grandchildren. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for the questions. Okay, we'll take a few questions. What we'll do, as we always do, we'll take three or four questions. That's probably all we have time for, one after another. And then Rabbi Twersky can answer the questions in one shot, so I'll give him my pen if he wants to take a few notes. And so David will walk around. If anybody has any comments, it's a little... Okay.
I'd like to ask, I'd like to ask you, Rabbi Twersky, what do we do when we encounter someone else, perhaps in a position of authority above us, who doesn't behave in a menschlich way? Somebody who, like, there you are, you're put on the spot, you see that they're behaving arrogantly or just simply not in a menschlich way, they've put you down in some way. What is the process you're supposed to go through mentally at that moment?
I must apologize that even though I have a $2,000 worth of hearing aids on each ear, right, I have a difficult time hearing anything over a loudspeaker. So can you tell me the...
What if you meet somebody who treats you, especially a person of authority, in a non-mentioned way? Let's say a rabbi, a teacher, but they treat you...
This is a very painful question, and I have just... trying to respond to it this morning while I was sitting here typing some answers to some questions that came into the Hamodia. And it had to do with children who were a woman who writes about how she suffered abuse and degradation from her husband, who turned the children against her. Right? And she gets no respect from her children. And if the children are observant of mitzvahs, right, then I suggest that have a rov to talk to them about what their obligations are in kibudem. Right? So regardless of what a parent does, right, there is still a mitzvah of being respectful toward the parent. And the same holds true in any situation, whether it's with a person of authority or a person with not necessarily authority, but a peer, right, where we have to learn how to behave respectfully toward people. Very interesting that the Talmud says that when we come up to the Beis Din Shamayla, when we have to face Judgment Day, that we will be asked, did you accept Hashem's rule? Did you accept, did you relate to Hashem royally? Right, as you would relate to a king. And the next question is, did you relate to other people royally as you would to a king? Both questions are, you know, they're equating relating to another person with the same kind of respect that we relate to Hashem. And the Pirkei Avos says it also. Let the honor of your teacher be as great as your own honor. Let the honor of your student be as great as your honor. Right? For a teacher to respect students. I mean, the concept of kovod is one where, you know, sometimes you'll say that person doesn't deserve to be respected. Right? But if we learn our Sifrei Musa, we learn how we must be able to overcome our own temptations, right, and how we have to learn how to relate respectfully to everyone, even though we don't want to.
Thank you. I didn't hear any reference to the concepts of Ava and Simcha. Ava and Simcha. Simcha as concepts of spirituality. I heard a lot about Siyugim, but not about those concepts.
Right. Very good comment. I did not mention much about Ahava and Simcha. Now, we've got to be careful about Ahava, right? Because Ahava really means the love of another person, not the love of oneself. And too often what goes for Ahava means the love of oneself. I mean, our culture is awash in love. Everything is love, 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 love. 50% of marriages end up in divorce. Where'd all the love go to? And the answer is, famous story of the Kotzka. The Kotzka saw a young man eating fish and enjoying the dish. He goes, young man, why are you eating the fish? He says, why am I eating the fish? Because I love fish. He says, oh, that's why you took it out of the water and killed it? Yeah, because you love it? He says, don't tell me. He says, there's nothing wrong with eating fish. Just don't tell me that you love the fish. But the fish tastes good to you, so because you love yourself, you eat the fish. Right? Today's marriages, too many of them are based on fish love. Right? I love the young woman because, you know, she satisfies me. I love the young man because he satisfies me. That's self-love. That's not a hava. What we mean by ahava is a true love of another person, of being willing to give of yourself and sacrifice for another person. I also talked about simcha. And simcha means more than simply contentment. Right? One says, look, if I'll only be free of all sorrows, I won't have any financial problems, I'll only be content. Right? Content is not simcha. Because simcha is a human attribute. And to prove that, go to your grocer next time, supermarket, go to the shelf where they sell evaporated milk, condensed milk, and look for the carnation milk. And look at the can which will advertise milk from contented cows. Right? Now, why should you be concerned about how the emotional health of a cow? Well, the manufacturer wants to tell you, my milk is better than the other competitors. Why? Because my milk comes from the finest cows. Why are my cows the most excellent? Because they're content. Meaning, excellence for a cow is contentment. And if all I'm looking for in life to be is content, then I share a goal in life with a cow. Right? That's not enough. Right? Simcha is not simply contentment. Right? You say, well, what is simcha? I wish I could tell it to you in two words. But simcha, I wrote a whole book about simcha entitled Simcha, Not Just Happiness. Sure, we have a bar mitzvah, chasen, and purim, simcha, and we rejoice. Yeah, that is one kind of simcha. There's many other kinds of simcha. Simcha does not simply mean happiness, because those are the kinds of happiness that I suppose if an animal is hungry and it gets to eat, so it's happy. Our simcha goes beyond that. Our simcha goes with the concept that we, unless we understand it properly, we don't know what the Gemara is talking about, where the Gemara says that for if chas v'sholem, something terrible happens to a person, he's supposed to make a brocha brocha dynamis, accepting Hashem's judgment. Right? And the Gemara says, and he should say it with simcha. What? A person lost a close relative and he's terribly griefy. Yeah? He's in grief and he should say it with simcha. So Rashi says, simcha does not mean joy here. The word simcha here means belev v'sholem, with a complete trust in Hashem. So simcha is more than just happy and contentment. And I go through perhaps another six or seven definitions of simcha. I'm glad you brought up the point. Simcha is a very important part of your Talmudic spirituality.
Okay, thank you very much. We have lunch now, so I have to cut off the questions.